kept hearing this rumor, an airplane crashed in Alaska, 30 people died, it was never found. I said, come on, that can't be true.
Scientists identify a victim from a plane that crashed 60 years ago. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 15th of August. Good evening, I'm Duncan Moon. Also tonight, a depressing reason for this summer's cool and wet weather.
There's still a lot of unknowns exactly what causes it to occur. We simply know that the ocean will go through a cooling pattern.
Those stories and much more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Harvesting wild game is extremely important to many Alaskans, not only as a food source, but as a long-standing traditional practice. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is committed to maintaining healthy caribou and moose populations. To learn more about the principles and guidelines behind predator management, visit wildlife.alaska.gov or contact your local fish and game office. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska, Department of Fish and Game.
Government prosecutors preparing to try Senator Ted Stevens have made fresh allegations about gifts they say he covered up. Yesterday was the deadline to file motions in the case, which charges Stevens with 7 federal counts of lying on his Senate financial disclosure forms. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, the government is trying to tighten its case against Alaska's senior senator.
The government motions, filed Thursday night, say Stevens didn't disclose a $31,000 interest-free loan from a friend that helped the senator turn a $5,000 Florida real estate investment into over $100,000. Prosecutors also allege that Stevens asked Bill Allen, the CEO of oilfield services company Vico, for things of value for Stevens' family, including a new Jeep for his daughter and jobs for his son and grandson. The government also gave more details about exactly what sort of gifts Vico allegedly gave to Stevens, citing a backup generator for his Girdwood home, which the government says Stevens asked for and received from Allen back in 1999. And prosecutors say communications between the senator and a friend show he knew he was guilty, that the emails, quote, demonstrate Stevens' consciousness of guilt concerning the conduct charged in the indictment. Earlier yesterday, Stevens' lawyers filed numerous motions to dismiss the charges, saying they're too vague, that some are outside a statute of limitations, and that the Senate should enforce its own rules about disclosure documents, not the courts. Stevens' lawyers also argued that as a senator, he should be protected by what's called the speech or debate clause, which says that a legislator's actions shouldn't be subject to judicial scrutiny. But the prosecutors fought back on that point last night, writing that their criminal case is not based on his legislative activities, but on the financial benefits Stevens tried to hide. They say the senator's actions went beyond his legislative duty, and so the speech or debate clause should not protect him. They want to include evidence that Vico did solicit Stevens and his staff, either directly or through lobbyists, and that Stevens helped get government contracts or federal grants for Vico or otherwise influenced government agencies. Their examples include a $40 million National Science Foundation grant and help Stevens gave to Vico when one of its subsidiaries was trying to build a pipeline in Pakistan. The prosecutors say Stevens also interfered with the state of Alaska's gas pipeline legislation on Vico's behalf. They plan to introduce as evidence recordings of phone calls about the gas pipeline legislation between Vico's Bill Allen, Senator Stevens and his legislative staff, and the senator's son, Ben Stevens, who at the time was the state Senate president. The government says Ted Stevens offered to influence members of the executive branch concerning the state legislation. They say Stevens told Bill Allen in one conversation that he would take action to accelerate and, quote, whittle down the federal permitting and review process. The case against Senator Stevens is scheduled to go to trial next month in the nation's capital, although Stevens' lawyers are pushing to have it move to Alaska. In Washington, D.C., I'm Libby Casey.
A real-life Alaska cold case has been solved. Officials have positively identified the remains of a victim who died in a plane crash in the remote Wrangell Mountains more than half a century ago. APRN's Alan Lockyer has more.
Northwest Airlines Flight 4422 crashed into Alaska's Mount Sanford in March of 1948. The plane was carrying merchant marine seamen from Taiwan to New York. 11 years ago, Northwest pilot Mark Milliken and Delta pilot Kevin McGregor located the wreckage within Wrangell-St. Elias National Park and Preserve. 2 years later, the two pilots found a dozen pieces of wreckage that identified the downed plane. They also found a human hand with part of a forearm, well-preserved in glacial ice. Friday, Kevin McGregor made an announcement to the press.
The arm and hand belongs to Francis Joseph Van Zandt. He's one of the merchant mariners that was on board Flight 4422.
Francis Joseph Van Zandt peers out from a sepia photo, one of a dozen or so moving across a laptop screen. He's got soulful eyes, a solemn but youthful face. Other photos show him in his merchant marine uniform, another with his arm around a Betty Grable look-alike blonde. He would never know that his life would end on a remote Alaska glacier. Genealogist Dr. Colleen Fitzpatrick.
Well, Frank came from Vermont. He was born in 1911, and we were able to find birth records of him and his siblings that indicated his mother was an Irish immigrant, Margaret Conway.
The story of how the researchers tracked down just who the hand belonged to is one for the books. Professor Ted Robinson was successful in lifting fingerprints from the mummified hand.
So what I would have to do was rejuvenate the skin so that fingerprints could be seen in the first place and then possibly identified with known fingerprint cards on file in the National Maritime Center.
Fingerprint expert Mike Grimm Sr. was called in next.
We were able to narrow it down to two individuals that had a possibility of being the owner of the hand.
DNA testing followed using the most recent techniques. The DNA was traced through a maternal line, according to acting state medical examiner Dr. Stanton Kessler. Genealogists traced Van Zandt's maternal ancestry back to County Limerick, Ireland. Operating on the slimmest of clues, they were successful in locating documents identifying Van Zandt's forebears. In the end, the only human remains found so far from the wreck of Flight 4422 will be put to rest. Dr. Kessler.
And it's extremely important on anybody, no matter who they are, we try to make an identification. And this could be anybody at all, whether he was a veteran or not a veteran or someone on the street.
Pilot Mark Milliken says he and McGregor have been researching the wreck of Northwest Flight 4422 since the 1990s.
Every year I thought it was the end of the trail and something else pops up.
As a pilot, he says he's been intrigued by the mystery of the wreck for years.
In 89, when I started flying the Pacific, I kept hearing this rumor, an airplane crashed in Alaska, 30 people died, it was never found. I said, come on, that can't be true. So that motivated me to find this airplane.
He says he and McGregor have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on a half dozen trips to the wreck site and subsequent research to find the families of survivors. But the mystery endures, and rumors of immense wealth that went down with the plane persist.
I'm not so sure that that's all true. From everything that we've researched and I've been to the site, I have to discount that. I really can't say that.
But there's gold in them thar movie rights, and Milliken says a book could be in the offing detailing the story of how the wreck was found. And Francis Joseph Van Zandt's name will be linked forever to a bit of Alaska history. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the struggle to establish a school that meets the needs of Native students.
They learn it through watching and doing, not sitting down in a desk and taking notes all day.
That's just ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by
Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
The cool and rainy weather across the state this summer could be the start of a trend. Climatologists are blaming it on a shift in a decades-long cycle that brings below-average temperatures, cloudy weather, and weak salmon runs. Gary Hufford is the regional scientist for the National Weather Service in Alaska. He says all signs point to a shift in the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, or PDO, which was first discovered by fisheries biologists at the University of Washington.
And in fact, what happened, they were studying red salmon fishery catches by commercial folks in Bristol Bay and found that when they looked at the catch, that there was every 20 years or so, there was this real decline for a short period of time. And the fact that it existed all the way back into the late 1800 records, it certainly intrigued them on what it might be. And so they began to work with the atmospheric scientists there at University of Washington. And in fact, one of the fishery students, Steve Hare, his last name spelled H-A-R-E, for his doctoral dissertation, actually gave it the name Pacific Decadal Oscillation as a indicator of what was going on. Well, since that period of time, which was 1996, so we're only talking about 12 years ago, we began to really start looking at this the oscillation again. It's like a lot like El Nino, but in different ways, where El Nino only occurs for a period of 2 years or so, 3 years. PDO can last 15 to 20 years. That's why we call it the Cadal effect.
I guess I'll stop having to pack away my sweaters every summer.
Yeah, I hear you. Because if you remember, just as an indication, we're going into what appears to be a cold phase PDO. We were in a cold phase PDO from 1947 to about 1976. And so you have an audience out there of old-timers that certainly remember the summers of the 70s where we tended to be much more cloudier, especially in August. Everybody would joke about the fact that about the time of the 15th of July, we would start to kind of go into our local monsoon season, a lot more rain, a lot more clouds.
Do we know very much about why it happens?
No, there's still a lot of unknowns exactly what causes it to occur. We simply know that the ocean, for reasons still unclear, will go through a cooling pattern, an interesting type of cooling pattern. When we're cold like this, the Pacific Northwest will be warmer. And if you watch the Oregon, Washington salmon runs, they've been very, very good this summer, though there was a lot of interest with the fact that the silver salmon runs further south in California are so poor. It appears that they're having a pretty good year with other salmon species in up the Columbia River, which is another indicator of this Pacific Decadal Oscillation, so that when we got good runs, Oregon and Washington had poor runs.
I mean, you've been talking about how this one of the keys of it is it affects the salmon runs. Does it affect any other kind of flora or fauna around the state?
Not so much in the sense that that's very clear. That's where we have the data in enough quantity and quality to feel comfortable to talk about. Obviously, on a season like this, certainly one asks themselves, well, what are we doing out there as other animals be affected by, hey, it's been a cloudy, cool summer. How's the berries out there? In fact, from what I've seen so far and heard from my friends, most of the berries are still green. They're not ripening well. They're small. All the signs of lack of sun. Certainly that has impacts on some of the animals and so forth. But these are things that are more anecdotal. We don't have the good records to see what other animals are doing.
Are the effects of PDO just visible? Are they felt only during the summer, or will this make a difference in the winter too?
It seems like they're mostly felt in the summer, though there is some evidence that it can affect precipitation in the winter so that we tend to get a little bit more snow.
Gary Hufford is a regional scientist for the National Weather Service in Alaska. Gary, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you betcha. Have a good one.
On August 26, Alaskans will vote on a ballot measure that would provide public funding for campaigns in Alaska. KBBI's Mike Mason reports.
Ballot measure number 3 was brought forward and successfully placed on the ballot by a group called Alaskans for Clean Elections. The group wrote 22 separate drafts of the initiative before settling on the version that will be before voters later this month. To get the issue on the ballot, the group had to collect signatures from over 33,000 registered voters in the state. The group's chairman is Tim June, who says ballot measure number 3 is the most important ballot measure since statehood.
What this does is it puts a voluntary system in place where participating candidates that can show a broad base of public support qualify for a set amount of public funding for their campaigns. And what it does is it addresses exactly what we're looking at the last 2 years with the VECO corruption. It addresses too much special interest money going into campaign contributions, and that unduly influencing the legislation that we see.
To qualify for public financing, a participating candidate is required to collect $5 from 3,000 registered voters if the candidate is seeking the office of governor. The number of $5 donations drops to 1,500 if the candidate is seeking the lieutenant governor's position, 400 for a state senate seat, and 200 for a seat in the state house. Candidates who qualify for public financing are then limited in the amount of money they can spend in the primary and general election. The amount of money that could be spent during a general election campaign ranges from $26,400 for a state house seat up to $550,000 for the general election for governor. The amount of funding for a run in the general election would range from $500,000 for a gubernatorial run down to $24,000 for a run for state house. Anchorage attorney Ken Jacobus is with the Committee to Stop Corruption, which wrote the statement in opposition that is included in the primary election pamphlet. He claims ballot measure number 3 is a bad idea for a number of reasons.
This ballot measure is called Clean Elections. It's not really clean elections. It means that the government pays for elections. It gives money directly to politicians, and that money is your money.
The state of Alaska prepared a statement of costs for the ballot measure that indicates it would cost the state nearly $12 million per election cycle. Jacobus also claims the ballot measure, if passed, would stifle free speech.
The expenditure limitations are relatively low, and in order for a candidate to beat an incumbent who has name recognition, the candidate has to spend more money in order to get the message out. This stifles this type of political expression. Finally, you know, you look at Vico as being a problem. Well, you know, Vico didn't get what it needed because of campaign contributions. Vico had to make separate bribes to people in order to get what it wanted.
There are currently 7 states with some sort of public financing for campaigns, and ballot measure number 3 was based on the public financing laws in many of those states. Tim June with Alaskans for Clean Elections admits that there will be some costs associated with ballot measure number 3, but he says the opponents are not dealing with the entire equation related to the cost.
This system is going to cost about $9 per Alaskan. And again, this is money coming from oil taxes. And if you look at last year's budget of $14.6 billion, each citizen essentially gets about $22,500 in benefits. So of that $22,500, this system is going to cost $9 of that. So it's a percent of a percent of a percent. It's incremental.
Voters can find information related to ballot measure number 3 and the other ballot measures on the primary election ballot by going to the Alaska Division of Elections website at elections.alaska.gov. In Homer, I'm Mike Mason.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Attention voters, Tuesday, August 26th is primary election day. Polling places will be open from 7 a.m. until 8 p.m. To find your polling place, call 1-888-383-8683 or in Anchorage, 269-8683. For additional information or other accommodations, please contact the Division of Elections at 907-465-4611. TTY TDD 907-465-3020. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
This week on AK, The Wonders of Alaska, we highlight the best of our state in an encore edition of a show first aired a year ago. So nice, you hear it twice.
The organizers of the new Alaska Native Cultural Charter School in Anchorage expected this August to be a realization of a long, hard-fought goal. Instead, the kindergarten through sixth grade school currently finds itself trying to fend off closure. KSK's Len Anderson reports.
For about 3 years, a group of Anchorage educators and parents labored to create what is now called the Alaska Native Cultural Charter School. They were motivated by the shared belief that some Native students just can't relate to mainstream classroom learning. So early this summer, they had a location, and according to school principal Tim Godfrey, a spring recruitment drive had supposedly produced the needed enrollment.
Going into the summer, we had a little over 200 applicants to the school. As we neared enrollment time, which is where we actually register them and get them in the school district system as coming to our school, our numbers dropped dramatically. As a matter of fact, they were cut in half.
Godfrey says one cause combined geography and the economy.
A lot of this has to do with transportation costs. Gas prices have risen dramatically. People can't afford to travel from one side of town to the other.
The school is located on the far east side of Anchorage, but many potential parents are in the south and west. Godfrey says a second cause is likely cultural.
We do have a lot of our native children who are still in the fish camps and in the villages helping their families gather food for the winter. Typically in the Anchorage School District, these children will come back around second week of September.
I don't like the idea of starting a school year with a school that has the potential to not continue if, in fact, we aren't going to get the adequate enrollment to meet their budget.
This week, Anchorage School Superintendent Carol Como faced an administrative dilemma. If more than 150 students are attending the school by October's official tally day, state funding will be about $1.2 million. But less than 150, funding drops to about $600,000. The facility cost alone is approximately $500,000 for the year, with salaries and benefits for staff and teachers roughly the same. Simply put, not enough students, not enough money. After a Wednesday meeting with charter school board members and Principal Godfrey, Como extended the new charter school's student number deadline into September. Anchorage schools start next Thursday. Como says she's familiar with the late registration pattern of people arriving from the bush. And Como says Anchorage needs the school. It could provide the much-needed transition from small rural schools to the much larger urban ones. She also says it offers an important alternative for some current district students.
An option for students who already live in Anchorage, and they don't all have to be Alaska Native or American Indian. It's really a different approach to learning, using the Native ways of learning, and that would benefit a lot of our students.
Godfrey described the educational approach of the Alaska Native Cultural Charter School.
There's something called the constructivist approach to learning, where the teacher is more of a guide, where kids can approach a problem, formulate ideas about how to solve it, and immediately work on solving it. This is great for Alaska Native children because that's the way in their culture that they typically learn. They learn through watching and doing, not sitting down in a desk and taking notes all day.
Like Como, Godfrey suggests this teaching method could be effective for some non-Native students, and the Native Influence curriculum is designed to meet state and federal benchmark academic standards. Como says whether in Anchorage or currently living outside the district, any parents thinking of enrolling their children in the school this fall should contact the school district right away, either by phone or via its website. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Organizers of Sitka's first farmers market are hoping it will raise the community's ability to eat locally. KCAW's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reports.
On average, Americans usually live about 1,300 miles from where their food is produced. Linda Williams, one of the organizers for the farmers market, says for Sitkans, that distance is probably even greater.
I imagine it's a couple hundred miles more for us. When you have that long distance to travel, that's going to take some time. You get 7 to 14 days in transit, you're going to lose some of the nutritional value and the flavor, especially with vegetables.
Plus, Williams says, if we eat food that has to be flown or barged in, that increases our carbon footprint and limits the variety of food we get.
You know, most of the fruit and vegetable varieties sold today are based on their ability to travel and the ability also for them to be harvested in an industrial manner. But there are many, many varieties of vegetables and fruits out there that we never even see in our grocery stores.
And that's where the farmers market comes in.
I think it's a fabulous idea.
That's Sitka gardener Lori Adams.
Produce costs a lot up here, and it's kind of the same idea as like the Victory Garden. You know, everybody could be a little bit more independent, and we could all grow a little something.
Adams has been gardening in Sitka for more than 15 years. She says she still struggles with things like getting the right nutrients for her root vegetables.
I don't grow enough volume to feed us. So it's more, right now, it's more like a hobby. So when the strawberries are ripe, I make enough jam to feed us for the whole year. I could put up enough rhubarb, enough raspberries. But to grow enough peas for a whole year, that's like impossible.
So if you go to the farmer's market and you've got carrots and someone else has tons of kale, for example, would you be inclined to, would you buy from them?
Oh, absolutely, except for I don't like kale. So. But if somebody did really good at growing broccoli or something like that, absolutely. Because our vegetables are so sweet because of our daylight hours. So many daylight hours. Not so much sun, but a lot of daylight hours. Right. And so when you eat broccoli that you've grown right here, it's like fantastic.
Organizer Carrie McLean says these things do take time to build. In 1993, he was the only booth at a farmer's market in Port Gamble, Washington. Today, that same market is sprawling with vendors. McLean says it's about drawing the community together using local resources as a starting point. And he says that means Sitka hopes to be more than just a farmer's market, but a fisherman's market as well.
Some of us don't. There's actually a whole bunch of people that don't have ready access to fish. I've gone to the co-op, and it's all gone down south, you know? And it's like, good, that's good. People are making money, but where's my fish, you know? So hopefully this will just be another outlet, you know, diversification of marketing.
In order to sell at the farmer's market, fishermen must have a processor's license, meaning anyone who can sell off their boat can sell at the market. Julia Schlutius of Sienna Seafood says that's not a problem for her family's frozen-at-sea processor, but she says getting a processor's license just for the market would be a lot of paperwork. Plus, the price of frozen-at-sea salmon is so high, she says she feels guilty charging her friends and neighbors what the fish is worth.
We're getting about $4 a pound for frozen-at-sea cohos, and if we fillet that fish, you know, that would take so much of the product away, and then having it vacuum packed on top of that, it would make a pound of coho about $7 or $6.50, which is probably offensive for people. They would not want to pay that price.
The Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association will have a cart available with fresh and frozen fish. But Carrie McLean adds there will be vendors with cooked seafood and a variety of other products as well.
A lot of people making jams and jellies, and we actually have some people saving seeds and growing plants for sale. Including native plants and some native edible plants. And we're really interested in trying to increase the amount of wildcrafted food. So introducing more seaweed into the diet and more local fungus.
Long-term plans notwithstanding, the early hopes for the community's first farmers market is to have fun and to start educating people about what Sitka can do. In Sitka, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Mike Mason in Homer, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Eli Menneker. John Prophet is our webmaster. And I'm Duncan Moon. From all of us here at the Alaska Public Radio Network, have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the State of Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Information about the state's predator management program is available on the web at wildlife.alaska.gov.
The Rasmussen Foundation, accepting applications from Alaska artists for project awards. The deadline is September 1st.
And by
BP, proud to support public broadcasting in Alaska.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.